Just want to welcome you to this presentation entitled Heritage Language, Family and Identity, Immigrant Parents, Children, and the Shaping of Ethno-Linguistic Belonging. So the person who will be presenting is Christina Solan Park. She is a fourth-year student at Barnard College of Columbia University, majoring in political science and education studies. Her research explores how individuals and communities sustain cultural and linguistic practices across generations, addressing broader questions of identity, belonging, and cultural continuity. This work reflects her longstanding engagement with Asian American and diaspora studies, exemplified by her role in the working group that helped establish Barnard's Asian Diaspora and Asian American Studies program, an initiative aimed at expanding academic and cultural spaces for underrepresented communities. Yay! Driven by curiosity about how cultural knowledge and identity are transmitted, preserved, and transformed, Christina seeks to carry these insights into her future endeavors, whether as an educator, attorney, or activist. Through her research, she aims to contribute to empowering communities and fostering inclusive practices, applying the lessons of her work to whichever professional path she pursues.
Hello. So this was a project that I worked on for a whole year for my senior thesis in the Education Studies Department. So this is a little bit about me. This is initially what drove the project. I grew up as a second-generation Korean-American. My parents had both immigrated here from Korea for university or for college. Because of that, my parents had some very strict ideas when it came to teaching me the language. So at home, my mom would often be like, "If you, as soon as you cross the threshold, you cannot speak a word of English. If you do, you have to put like 25 cents into like a piggy bank." So I was like losing money every time I spoke English. So that was an example of some very strict language policies within the household. So for me, that's essentially what motivated my studies, because I wanted to learn more about my peers and the kinds of language practices that they grew up under. Another part of what motivated this was I grew up speaking Korean as a first language. So before I even learned English, naturally Korean was my first language. And because of that, growing up, I was in the ESL program, so English as a second language program. Very shortly, they realized that my English fluency was a lot better than they had anticipated, so I was quickly removed from the program. But I know that a lot of my peers have very interesting and very different experiences from me, so I wanted to learn a little bit more about their experiences. And then growing up in Southern California in Los Angeles, I think that this definitely also impacted the way I think about like my identity. Being surrounded by a lot of Asian Americans, I don't think that I had as much of an issue or a lot of conflicts in that area, so I was interested in hearing from peers who grew up in like white-dominated spaces and to see how that definitely impacted the ways that they perceive themselves within their heritage language spaces. So I guess kind of like a question that I wanted to pose to like an audience, for like I guess like show of hands, how many of you guys grew up speaking more than one language in the household? Yeah, so I guess like that's kind of like the majority of people here. So that with looking back, if anyone's interested in sharing, because okay, I initially had this like QR code like Menti, but I can't even pull that up. So I'm just gonna ask if anyone's comfortable sharing. What kinds of emotions come up when you look back at your experiences learning language?
Shame.
Yes. Yes. Trauma. Yes. Yes, very valid. Also, I feel like a lot of people relate to that. I relate to going to Korean school as well, so definitely. Any other emotions related to language learning? You guys can just shout it out. No? Shame, embarrassment, trauma. All valid. Those are all also reactions that came up in my study. So this is a quote that I wanted to kind of open up with. This is one of my favorite quotes from my participants. Allison is also second-generation Korean-American. My studies didn't necessarily particularly focus on second-generation immigrants or Korean-Americans in particular. However, her experience was very similar to mine, and I thought that this quote was very beautiful, and it kind of demonstrates the kinds of ideas that I want to share through this thesis. She said that language is something that's very living, and because it's so living and so fluid, it can be complicated or as simple as any relationship with a human being. And with that, language is very vulnerable because you have to be really okay with not being able to express yourself correctly or not being able to come across in the ways that you intend. So a lot of participants also expressed this, where the reason why they didn't want to use their heritage language was because they're afraid that they're going to, start a miscommunication or not be able to communicate as well as they would have liked. So this was my research question. Originally, I had aimed to study parents and children's understandings of heritage language and identity. No, it's okay. But ultimately, though, I ended up focusing on children simply because that was the access or the kind of access that I had to this particular sample was mostly just with children or so my peers. I think moving forward in the future, it would be very interesting to do an intergenerational study. But my focus was on understanding how children understand their heritage language and their identity. So these were my methods. Originally, I had planned to, being at Barnard College, I felt that my access to participants would mostly be women, so I want to focus specifically on female-centered participants. This was also influenced a lot by the literature that I read on language brokering, which I'll get into a little bit later. But it's the idea that children often are forced to mature or grow up sooner because they act as a broker between their parents and between formal institutions simply because they're more fluent in English. And a lot of the literature noted that mostly daughters or like the eldest daughters were responsible for this role. So initially that's why I was interested in studying only female participants, but later I was able to also recruit male participants, so it kind of shifted. And I think a lot of what they were saying also supported the literature that I was reading. Additionally, I had aimed to do about 6 to 8 interviews and do 2 focus groups, but after conducting 1 focus group of approximately 3 people, I realized that it's probably best to do interviews because I'm asking a lot of people about their personal experiences, their families, and the ways that they grew up. So I quickly learned and like pivoted that I think I should focus on interviews. So I conducted 12 interviews, and I coded my responses based on the literature, so what I was expecting to find based on the existing body of literature, and then I created a second set of codes based on the things that I was hearing. So I grouped my findings into 4 main points, or like 4 main buckets. So the first is the idea that language practices go beyond parental intent. So this is the idea that despite parents maybe stricter or I guess stronger intent to transmit the language, a lot of times whether or not a child retains the language is based not on parents' intent, but on other institutional factors and assimilation pressures beyond that. And then the second one was that heritage languages are sites of shame, pride, and longing. So a lot of kind of along with that line of being embarrassed of using the language, and then later as they became young adults, they're interested in reclaiming it. The third one was about language brokering. So as I kind of mentioned before, that idea that children take on a more adult role within their households despite their young age simply because of their fluency. In terms of language brokering, I was looking at the normalization of it and also the resistance. The normalization kind of looking more at the ways in which this action is something that's expected of the children and not, I mean, I think I will definitely also get into this, but it's kind of the idea that despite children wanting to do this service for their parents, despite them obviously like loving their parents and wanting to do what's best for them, there's still this conflict or like this tension that kind of makes things a little bit uncomfortable for them. And lastly, and I think that this was something that was the most meaningful to me, was that the negotiation of identity and this idea that participants are going between these spaces of being too much and also not enough at the same time. This idea that they don't necessarily belong to one space, whether that be from like their parents' country of origin, parents, grandparents, whoever's country of origin, and also the United States. So this is a general summary of my findings. So getting into it, the first finding was that language dominance shifts towards English and is not just based on what parents had intended, but it's also based on assimilation and structural factors. This participant in particular, Jonathan, had grown up in Arizona. He had shared with me that he had gone to a school that was actually 98% Latino. But despite that, he shared that a lot of the administration had enforced this very strict language practice, where even during recess, during lunchtimes, children weren't allowed to speak Spanish when this was something that children had been very used to. And so with that being said, he mentioned that English was something that was trained into them and Spanish trained out. So with that, considering that a lot of the time during social interactions, Spanish was banned, he said that even like now as an adult, he realizes that even if he is able to speak Spanish or knows that his peers also speak Spanish, he finds himself speaking English because of this pressure and because of this habit of having language trained out of him when he was so young, and also like considering or remembering that in social environments, this is something that was actively policed. And to expand a little bit more on my findings, the first one is that despite parents' the first finding or first sub-finding was that children did not view parents' decisions to suppress heritage language as something that was abandoning their cultural values. A lot of them realized or felt as if this was a defense mechanism instead. One participant in particular, she is a third-generation Okinawan immigrant. She shared that her grandmother had actively forced her children to not use Japanese, and naturally because of that, she isn't able to speak Japanese as well. But then instead of thinking or blaming her grandmother for this decision, she said that this was only right or this was justifiable because she felt that this was a move to protect, like, herself and her family. And then next is that structural pressures, in addition to having... The second point is that because children spend more time in English-dominated environments, children are forced to lose their heritage language. This was very common, and I think this is normal along a lot of people my age and also growing up in the United States. Because naturally you're spending more time in schools using English, a lot of the times it's just a natural thing, even if there isn't as much of an assimilatory pressure placed on you. Like Jonathan's example or Jonathan's school is an example of a very extreme school. But even for children who went to school in, I guess, like, more diverse spaces and where, like, diversity wasn't as, like, punished or, like, I guess, policed, children still noted that because they were spending more time in schools, naturally they're starting to lose their heritage language. And then lastly, it was the idea of peer pressure and social belonging that motivates heritage language loss. Something that was very interesting was that there wasn't a lot of mention of bullying or active bullying of students that, like, pushed, like, heritage language loss. Rather, this peer pressure that we're talking about was actually the thought that they were excluding other peers if they were speaking a foreign language. So, for example, one of my participants mentioned that while she and a few of her friends also spoke Cantonese together, they didn't want to use Cantonese with their other friend because they knew that they couldn't speak the language. So this peer pressure wasn't, I guess, like, a force that necessarily... was negative. It was often in an effort to include others that they weren't using their heritage language. So in these situations, they found that they weren't able to use their heritage language in social settings. My second finding was that heritage language serves as a site of shame, pride, and longing. In this quote in particular, one of my participants shared that if you're unable to communicate with someone in their primary language, oftentimes you're not able to form a deeper connection with them. This is something that I deeply resonated with when I think about my parents, for example. I think that apart from being able to say hi, bye, hello, or ask someone, what is your favorite color or what is your favorite food, I think that it's very difficult to know about a person's being, their past, like their present, and like their future, and like their aspirations if you're unable to communicate with them in their most comfortable language. So in this way, heritage language I learned was a site of a lot of times longing. And then to expand upon my second finding was that attrition was often linked to feelings of shame or embarrassment from childhood, which is something that is very normal. One of my participants particularly, or a lot of them remember the specific moment where they realize I no longer want to speak the language. One of my participants, who is a second-generation Cambodian immigrant, said that an uncle had often made fun of the way she speaks Khmer, and because of that, she immediately remembers that moment and has since then refused to learn the language because she's always embarrassed and reminded of that traumatic memory. Something that's also very interesting to note is that these incidents of shame and embarrassment weren't necessarily from white-dominated spaces. They're actually in spaces where they're surrounded by family members and also their heritage language community. So that's also something that was very interesting. It's that I think there's often an expectation that there's a white society or a predominantly white institution that polices language. But instead, we found that a lot of families poke fun at participants, and also a lot of cousins, for example, who are from their parents' country of origin will also make fun of them, saying, your Korean sounds like a baby, or I don't think you should try speaking like Korean anymore. And I think a lot of the times these situations were a lot more embarrassing for children rather than incidents that happen in schools. And the second part, or the second sub-finding, is that a lot of the times lived experiences and exposure to more diverse communities inspire participants to re-engage with the language. So considering that most or all of my participants are actively students at the moment and undergraduate students, many of them mentioned that despite being ashamed or afraid in or growing up, coming to, for example, this was done in Columbia and Barnard, so they said that coming to a more diverse space, being in a more diverse city, being surrounded by more people, they were encouraged to reclaim their identity. So a lot of the times, because also our school has a language requirement, many of them found that it was kind of a nice way to get back into engaging with their heritage language. And also there are specific heritage language speaker classes provided at Columbia for a lot of different languages. A lot of students found that that was very motivating to reclaim their language. And then the last point was that the idea or the thought of losing intergenerational connection was something that also served as a motivator. One participant in particular mentioned that her parents' first language wasn't actually, her first language is Cantonese, but her parents both speak a different different dialect of Cantonese. And then so with that, she mentioned that Cantonese is the last, for her, the last piece that connects her to her parents. And as she notices that her parents are reverting back to their first languages, that fear of losing that, even that slightest connection, is what drives her and motivates her to continue to learn the language. And the same goes for a lot of participants who mentioned that they had a family member who had fallen ill, and slowly, you know, whether that be grandparents, uncles, aunts, whoever, they noticed that they're starting to also slowly lose their English skills. So with that, a lot of them learn to reclaim their language in order to connect with their loved ones. So grief and like the thought of losing that intergenerational connection was a really big motivator to reclaiming language. And for my third finding, it was that language brokering is an experience that is like simultaneously normalized and burdensome. This is an example of a participant who grew up here in Chinatown. She mentioned that a lot of what highlights her experience growing up as second generation was defined by these moments of language brokering. She noticed, or she shared, that there isn't a moment of her childhood that she can remember where she wasn't actively translating between her parents and someone else. So in this specific example, she was mentioning an interaction at like Macy's. She also mentioned that she was always doing paperwork for her family, whether that be like going through like bank statements, immigration papers, etc. And even into college, she continues to step into this role like every single time, despite her sister being able to fully also do that role. So with that, the first sub point was that it's something that's established and often persists. So in the case of Xin Yi in the first example, this was something that continued even into adulthood. Her sister is also able to do these things, but once established, she mentioned that her dad trusts in her and often believes that she can just continue doing that work. So it's something that's very normalized. And the second part is that this is actually very emotional labor that often goes invisible and unnoticed. I think because of a lot of parents kind of expect this of their children, or it's not that, so children do this because they love their parents and they obviously want to accurately reflect the things that they want to share with whoever. There's also that burden or a lot of pressure that children are facing when they're in this role. And in that way, because it is so normalized, a lot of the times parents aren't noticing that this is actually a form of labor. And just that you love someone does not mean that this labor is not labor. And the last part is that language brokering creates divergent outcomes across siblings. Generally, as I mentioned before, the expectation or the literature suggests that the eldest child has the greatest proficiency. I mean, whether it's the idea that your parents stop trying after the second, like after the first child, or it's the idea that, you know, as the first child, a lot of times families, like grandmothers, grandfathers, will come and visit and help raise the first child. Like, that's often the reason why, because they were surrounded by so much more of that language, they have a higher proficiency, or it's expected. But I learned that that wasn't necessarily always the case. I learned that for a lot of participants, maybe it's just also their like ego and like their like confidence, but a lot of them were saying, oh no, I actually think that my Spanish is better than my sister's, or oh, my Vietnamese is much better than like my older sister's. I noticed that the ways in which they evaluate language proficiency is also something that was very different. So a lot of the times they were mentioning things like, because their older siblings were used to translating, their grammar is perfect, their vocabulary is more advanced, but they mentioned that a lot of the times their older siblings were not able to take these conversations into the streets. They weren't able to have these social interactions on the regular, whereas they felt that they had a lot more of that like social element and they were able to carry these conversations on the regular. So with that, I also realized that fluency necessarily should not be measured only by grammatical sense or like advanced language, but we should also think about the ways in which we use language outside of these like so-called translator settings. And then my last finding was that there is this sense of feeling too much and also not enough. This quote very, I think, aptly describes this experience where a lot of children feel like they don't necessarily belong to one society or another. And I think I originally focused on the ways in which language plays a role in this. A lot of my interviewees were mentioning and saying that, oh, like, I don't feel like, insert, like, for example, like Korean enough or like Mexican enough because I don't speak insert language. And definitely language is something that plays a role into this, but there's also a lot of layers that go into the reason why people don't feel as though they belong or they feel excluded. The first part is that participants don't feel enough and inauthentic in heritage spaces, and language proficiency is one of these things. I think a lot of the times what participants were echoing were the sentiments that even if they understand fluently, they're not able to respond. So even if they claim that they understand fully, when they're not able to carry on a conversation with like their loved ones, their extended families, a lot of the times their extended families will just end up cutting them off, like shutting down and saying, oh, it's okay, we can speak English together. And I think because of that, like that kind of destroyed confidence related to speaking the heritage language is what kind of stunts their like growth in terms of advancing or like maintaining the language and also connecting with their cultural identity. And then the next idea is that participants feel as though they're too much or they're marked as others in white spaces. And a lot of the times, this was more prominent among participants who had grown up in predominantly white spaces. Those who grew up in more diverse areas, I think, didn't mark as much or did not think too much about it. But oftentimes people felt that the physical appearance or just the way that we look is the reason why they get othered in spaces immediately, even before they start speaking the language. And that kind of idea followed along in diasporic context. So I asked a lot of participants, so, you know, when you visit, you know, the motherland, so to speak, can other people tell that you're American? Most of the times the answers were yes, immediately clocked. They know that you're an American. And I asked them, so, like, you know, like, why is it that or why do you feel that way? And a lot of the times it was based on appearance. It was the way you look, the way you carry yourself. A lot of people said, oh, it's the way people do their makeup. And people said that before I even opened my mouth, they knew, like, that I wasn't from here. So this was kind of an example that showed that it's, like, a very odd dynamic where you feel like in the States you aren't able to be fully American versus when you also visit the motherland, you're not able to fully claim your identity, and over there they consider you as American. So ultimately for limitations and future studies, I'm thinking a lot about, like, my sample size. I got to interview 12 people, and for a senior thesis, this is pretty good, but I think obviously for further studies, it would be nice to talk to a lot more people. In terms of diversity, I think that I had a pretty diverse sample that reflected the diversity of Barnard and Columbia, but even then, Barnard and Columbia are not as diverse as we would like to say or like we would like to think, so I think that that's definitely something that I would like to work on for recruitment. And also for future studies, I would like to interact with parents. I think that interviewing children was also very interesting, but I think the ways in which the ways that parents implemented their family language practices was kind of based on it was purely based on the ways that children perceived them. So children thought that their parents weren't enforcing strict language practices, or some, you know, thought so. But I think it would also be nice to talk to parents to see if they think that their practices were strict or not. I think that could be a very interesting comparison between the two. And then also kind of focusing and zeroing in on that gendered lens of language brokering again would also be very interesting. And I think that if I were to conduct this study again, I think it would also be interesting to do a generational study. So if I had one family in particular and interview across, I don't know, maybe between like 3 to 4 generations of like the family, I think that could also be a very interesting way to kind of trace the ways that language was maintained, taught, passed down, and et cetera. So yeah, I think for future studies, that's something that I'm considering. And for implications, I think considering that this was an education studies thesis, I thought a lot about the ways in which we teach language. I think that a lot of times in language, we're very interested in just passing on like fluency and like fluency in a way that students are able to succeed, you know, professionally, like academically, et cetera. But I think that oftentimes we often lose that affective dimension of heritage language. It's often not just motivated by like structured access, but also being a part of a community that really affirms your identity. I think that a lot of schools view language or a second language as a deficiency, and I think that that's something that definitely needs to be changed. The same goes for ESL programs. We evaluate based on fluency and whether or not children are able to learn English well enough to continue on with their peers, but I think it oftentimes it comes at the cost of students losing their heritage language. So I think that there is also a value in recreating or restructuring ESL programs so that children are able to continue to maintain their heritage language concurrently with advancing their English proficiency. And then lastly, I think that it's very important to build safer communities where immigrant parents feel welcomed rather than dismissed. I know that personally for my mom, it was something that was very difficult to go to parent-teacher conferences because, you know, despite her completely understanding everything, she felt as though she couldn't respond or, I guess, accurately express her opinions or her ideas. So I think that it's very important for schools to build safer environments where they feel welcomed and not dismissed. And these are my conclusions. But yes, thank you. Any questions?
Well, I want to put it to you that the same trauma exists in communities with native English speakers from different places.
Mm-hmm.
Because this
That's
is
interesting.
What Americans in Europe have called creolizing.
Mm.
But back in your country, we say that Americans speak creolizing. So what happens when those kids come here, they get, I don't know if the word is bullied, but elements of that exist because
the students who speak American English
mm-hmm.
will laugh at them or say things.
Mm-hmm.
So then the trauma begins, right? And mm-hmm. if a kid comes here at 7 or 8 years old, goes into school and that happens, of course it has a personal effect on them.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to encourage you to expand your research to include native English speakers from
mm-hmm.
other countries.
Mm-hmm. Wait, that's very interesting. Because also like the idea of like accents, like
yes.
I think growing up, obviously we just noticed that it's something that's different and
mm-hmm.
I think kids start to kind of pick fun at like differences and kind of, but I think that's very interesting. And
you didn't mention code switching.
Code switching.
Yeah.
That was actually something that's interesting. I expected that in like my research, like going into it, I was expecting people to say that they code switch between different places, but a lot of them didn't mention it. That's why I think it was very interesting because my sample was so small that I didn't see this. But yeah, that's definitely something I read up on but didn't see, which is very interesting too.
That happens a lot in
our mm-hmm.
Thank you for this. I imagine that the literature you found for this was primarily thinking about language acquisition
mm-hmm.
Was probably with like Spanish speakers, Spanish immigrants, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just thinking about, you know, like how important it is to have this kind of research, you know, particularly around, you know, Asian diaspora communities and especially in New York City. There are just so many thoughts that I have about this.
Mm-hmm.
I was just thinking about the way that you wanted to expand it to include the POV of parents, but I could already see like the challenges
mm-hmm.
that would come from that just on account of, you know, the English language
yep.
abilities, right? And then having to navigate that. And as somebody who is Cambodian, I came here as a refugee with my family from the Khmer Rouge genocide, and this all sounds very familiar, and also that Cambodian subject that you were, whom you were talking about, you know, it's in our community, it's like teasing, but culturally, as an American, it could be taken the
mm-hmm.
wrong way, and then it creates this situation of like, okay, I don't want to learn,
mm-hmm.
and I would be interested in seeing, like, I frankly, like, more specific. I think more specific situations, because, for example, in the Cambodian community, because of the Khmer Rouge regime, when they tried to start a year zero, they tried to eliminate everything, you know, from the language, culture, killing off intellectuals, anybody from the previous regime, to wipe the slate clean. And so to come here as resettled refugees who are under duress, language was one of the few things that we still carried with us.
Mm-hmm.
And so for the generation not to be able to speak it was a real, like, painful thing for us to hear on a daily basis and to
mm-hmm.
expect that. So it's a very special situation, certainly for my community, because a lot of people are losing. We have a lot of people who are, you know, marrying out of, you know, Cambodians. And so then you have, like, the loss of that language
mm-hmm.
as well. But we've got young teachers who are changing their pedagogy to be more liberatory, where they're being more inclusive, rather than like what you were talking about, the, you know, Chinese school. Like, we used to have the Buddhist monks who would like hit you if you weren't speaking Cambodian correctly. And it's like, you know, trying to move away so that the new language practices could be much more about linguistic justice and language reclamation. So I'm just thinking that it's making me think that I want to do this research now, but I'm thinking about like the specificity of the Cambodian situation makes it stand out from, say, you know, those who are Chinese, like those who have been here for generations Chinese versus those who have come over, those who have different class backgrounds. I mean, it just, you know, I recognize that you were limited in terms of like time, the amount of interviews that you did, but it seems like it could go in so many directions, like where you are now. And so I'm very curious to see, like, I guess I'm curious to know, like, what is the thing that's driving this for you, and what are you particularly interested in seeing more of or learning more about?
I think also thinking specifically about your case or your community, I think this is also something that's really interesting, because considering that she had been born in the United States, there is that bit of like a gap where for her, like, it wasn't just teasing. Like, to her, that was like shame and embarrassment. But I'm sure that like it would be very interesting to examine and hear from their perspective to see like what were they thinking when they were like teasing her? Like, were they just teasing her? Which I'm sure they were. But like, still, again, like, to the person who was experiencing that, I'm sure, you know, that's very different. So I think that also really goes to show and like demonstrates the difference between growing up here, like being Americanized, like growing up here, being socialized here, versus interacting with relatives who grew up in another country, or like extended relatives who are maybe like from like older generations. And I think it's also very important that you brought up like class and also like the reason for migration. Also another avenue for research that I think would be very interesting is comparing like the reason why you migrated here. Like, for example, my parents migrated here, fortunately, for academics, versus someone who had migrated here to escape genocide. Like, those are two very different conditions. And I definitely understand that the ways that parents may feel about language transmission is also very different. For example, another participant who I had mentioned, she's third generation, like, Okinawan. For her and for her grandmother, considering following the aftermath of World War II, she thought that any signs of marked difference, like speaking Japanese, would be something that's dangerous to her community. So again, like, thinking about the reasons why, like, you immigrated, and like the generation, or like the time period, or like the era you migrated, was something that was really interesting. Because, for example, my parents immigrated here in the 90s, versus someone whose parents immigrated here in the 60s and like earlier, or like even like the 70s, like that's very different. So considering that my peer group, considering I think around our age, most parents had immigrated in like the 90s-ish, or some people had immigrated even later, like in the 2000s. So considering that is like very different. Also, where you migrated to was something that was very like drastically different. Like, migrating somewhere, for example, like upstate Connecticut versus migrating to Los Angeles, those are two very different things that definitely impacts like the ways parents even think about transmitting the language. Like, my parents were thinking that, oh, like, let's just focus on Korean because she'll learn English eventually. Versus for other families, they might think that, oh, it's best to learn English quickly and only adapt and use English, because they're afraid of that difference or being like marked different besides the way that they appear. So even talking in their like native language outside was something that was brought up for a lot of participants who grew up in like white dominated areas. They mentioned that they wouldn't be speaking English because they're like afraid of that difference. But that a lot of like younger people now say that coming to New York City, or like having their parents visit, like being in the city, they feel a lot more comfortable being able to speak the language with them here versus using the language back in their hometowns.
Pull across different immigrant groups and to find such, you know, a number of commonalities between them. I think that's really impressive. And one of the things that I did want to add, you know, because that's a research question in itself, right? Like, in the diaspora, there's these tensions that rise, right? You know, and I think language is definitely one of the arenas where those tensions become really visible. And I do sometimes, I mean, there could be different reasons. There could be cultural differences, transcultural differences. Maybe one teasing could be seen as really offensive, but teasing could also be normalized. But I think, like, what I found, though, I found quite a few different reasons for why that happens. I'm Bangladeshi, and part of the Bangladeshi diaspora. I've had different explanations of why, like, that when you try to speak Bengali why people respond negatively across a wide range. I asked my mom, like, why, like, she feels a need to constantly correct me or, you know, because she laughs, right? And she was like, well, it sounds funny, and, you know, she's not used to it, but she didn't realize that it was discouraging me mm-hmm. from speaking Bengali. So I asked her, I was like, could you try not to laugh every time? Like, could you, like, mm-hmm. be a little bit more open? And I didn't realize communicating even that, like, because we're so afraid to tell our parents how we feel mm-hmm. and how to be vulnerable around that. Ask them, like, and you know, it's different relationships across different parents. And I was, like, 30 when I was able to communicate that to her, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so it's really hard. And then the other, like, experience I had is when I was in college, I did the critical language studies. Like many of your mm-hmm. classmates, I really wanted to relearn Bangla again. And I went to Bangladesh, and they had a special class for the heritage speakers. And it was a really traumatizing experience because Bangladeshis there, they either thought, one, that I was really stupid for coming back to Bangladesh and trying to learn Bengali when I speak such good English and I could be using that to further myself. And two, they were more impressed with the white students who were able to speak Bengali. The fact that the white students were able to speak, but they value that more than what I, you know, what me and some of the other heritage speakers were trying to do to reclaim that. They did not see that as impressive. They did not see that as valuable. So I really found that very interesting that different reasons, people have different reasons for why they respond that way. Now, that could be a research project in itself.
That's true.
That transcultural hierarchy tensions around language.
Mm-hmm. Amelia, you got a question? No, it's okay. Wait, but also kind of to add on to that, like, I think that's definitely something I've experienced as well. And a lot of things that people also, I'll like briefly answer or like expand. One of my participants also mentioned that he speaks Spanish fluently, or he thinks fluently, like, he evaluates himself as being more of an understander rather than fluent, but I think his Spanish is a lot better than he thinks. But obviously, my Spanish is not great, so I can't be evaluating that. But he studied abroad in Brazil, and that's when he also started picking up Portuguese. But for him, he found that a lot of people, or he feels more comfortable speaking Portuguese. Also, his partner is Portuguese, so he finds that it's a lot more comfortable speaking Portuguese than Spanish, because when he's speaking Portuguese, people are like, wow, like, you're really good at this, or like, wow, like, you picked it up so fast, versus speaking Spanish at home and, like, with family and other spaces, because he feels like there's always that pressure that, like, because you belong to this community, you're already expected to be better at it than others. So it's that same phenomenon where, you know, versus, like, white students, you know, like, we have this, like, weird, like, double, like, standard, like, expectation. So, yeah, I definitely also realized that, too, and could be also a further study.
I you know, in terms of, like, the diaspora, like, each particular, like, ethnicity has its own sort of layers, and I just wonder, like, to actually dig deep into, like, maybe one language community, similar to, Tasbih, I'm also from the Bangladeshi mm-hmm. community, so it's a different experience where, because of our political history, where we actually, like, International Language Day is because Bangladeshis fought for it. So, like, since you're, like, 2 years old, it's like, you have to speak Bangla because, you know, we fought, we gave blood for it. Yeah. So it's a different kind of, it's almost like a pride to mm-hmm. learn language. So it would be interesting to hear the different trajectories across different mm-hmm. communities to really dig deeper, and then across time periods. So, mm-hmm. again, not to add more work for you, but and this is beyond your scope, but as a now 1.5 generation, I was born in the United States with children who are multiracial, like mm-hmm. my husband is Spanish speaker. It's a whole other challenge. So I just want to say, like, in terms of, like, even when you have a community or parents who are supportive, the dominant white supremacist culture is so strong that it's like there's still shame, even, like, some of this has to be structural.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it can't just be instilling pride because, mm-hmm. I mean, just to see my kids who are still kind of reluctant to speak. They'll read it, mm-hmm. everything, they identify it, but to speak out loud, mm-hmm. there's something about marking that. So mm-hmm. it's just interesting to, like, then look from your study, like, what are some structural solutions? Because yeah. it's just not enough to just have, like, hey, you should learn our language yep. and have pride, because most of the society actually is very monolingual and very pride, very boastful of the fact that, like, you know, and of course all of us have the experience where, how is it that you speak English so well? It's like,
I was born here.
Right. I wasn't born here, but it's like also like I was colonized, right? And English was the language of colonization. That makes them uncomfortable, but the point is that I speak more than one language. What do you speak, you know? Right. And just to flip the paradigm of linguistic diversity. But I love your research, and I think just to push to think about structural solutions. The last thing I'll mention, if anyone's thinking about Fulbright, what's interesting, there's a very controversy about heritage speakers and then who are disadvantaged in the process versus non-heritage speakers. Because the idea is that if you're a heritage speaker, you already know the language, and therefore you're not getting that cultural exchange. And it and so we need to actually push back, and these institutions that give us, give our students or give each of us like opportunities to go abroad. So just a, I think there's a lot of like societal and institutional things that your research can really, you know, kind of challenge through the work that you're finding. So please do continue. I don't know, I don't know what level of study you're at, but whatever the next level is, continue.
Thank you.
How is it different speaking here, Bangla, and in country? Is there a difference for you?
Well, you know, the thing, we have like other layers that we have regional differences. As the brother mentioned about Cantonese and Toisan, we like Bengali has multiple dialects. So I also suffer from, I come from a region that doesn't speak it proper. And so there is a proper Bengali, and then there's like, and that's class and all that stuff. Right. So I won't go into, like, if you want offline, I can give you 101, but it's much layered. Okay. Yeah.
Hi, thank you. First, I want to say you did a great job. We were at the table in the morning. Yeah. You did an awesome job. Also, I wanted to ask if you, you know, you spoke with 12 participants, and they were from different cultures and languages. Was there any difference you found with participants who came from, who spoke Spanish or Italian at home and who spoke like maybe Bangla or Korean at home? Because specifically in terms of like reading the language, because, you know, with Spanish, even though, yes, it's a completely different language than English, at least the letters are the same. But with Korean or Chinese or Hindi or Bangla, like, it's a completely different language family. So I went, did you see any differences between how participants learned English from, you know, even because English is from the same family, Romantic languages and the other languages? Thank you.
Off the top of my head, I can't think about specifically, like, reading, but I feel like I focus a lot on, like, the affective dimensions. I think for a lot of Spanish speakers, there's this term, like, no sabo, and, like, no sabo, like, is not accurate because it's, like, no say, like, I don't know, but instead people say, like, no sabo because, like, that's, like, a term, like, not necessarily, like, a derogatory term, but, like, a word that they use to describe children who can't, you know, speak the language. I think I noticed that within a lot of Spanish-speaking communities, there was more active, like, blaming and shaming to pressure them into speaking the language, but in like a, but then the children didn't perceive it as shaming, and like in a sense where it wasn't like debilitating for like further like language like maintenance. Instead they thought of it as like an expectation that, oh, like, you know, like they only, they're like pressuring me, or like they're like making fun of me because, like, you know, I should know this. And there was like that expectation. So in that affective like dimension, I think that's something that was a little bit different compared to like others. But in terms of reading, I think that would be something that's very interesting also, to compare between different languages. But yeah, I'll think about that.
Do you speak Korean?
Yes.
Oh, you do?
Yes. That's what drove the study. Like, I speak Korean. I speak Korean with my parents, and I think it was driven by the fear of the loss of Korean. A lot of participants also mentioned, like, oh, like, we asked, like, so I asked them, like, oh, so in the future, do you want to pass down your language to, you know, if you want kids, or if you even want, like, decide to, like, would you want to pass down the language? And there was a lot of anxiety surrounding that, because they were like, well, if my Korean isn't good enough, how am I going to pass that on to, like, the next? It's going to be, like, a weird, like, broken, like, Korean being passed down. So yeah, I think that's kind of what motivated it. But yes, I speak Korean.
You discover a lot of
Mm-hmm.
Did you find that in certain English words when they speak in English?
Oh, like
Korean.
Yeah, like Konglish. Yes. Or like there's terms for like every single one, I think.
Yeah.
And sometimes like when we're interviewing, like for example, the interviewees who I was or who were Korean, when they would speak Korean, they would use English. So we use Konglish.
Hi. So just to piggyback on that, that's why I came to the session as well too, because I have a child. And what you mentioned before, you know, because of everything that you mentioned in terms of like the shame and everything, my native language is pretty broken, but I want to pass on that to my child. And I'm just thinking, you know, this is probably another study as well, too. But because of all that, I'm trying to figure out what's the best way to pass on the language to my children without that shame, without that mm-hmm. embarrassment. I feel it's very difficult because, you know, generationally, between my family, it's very segregated.
Mm-hmm.
So just having the language part, I think, is very important. But I'm just still trying to figure out different ways how to pass on that language without, like, the generational trauma,
mm-hmm.
without that embarrassment and that shame as well, too.
Yeah.
Because when I think about that language and the culture, I'm like, oh, you're going to remember all the bad stuff first more than the positive
mm-hmm.
stuff. So I found this really interesting, and I hope that you continue on with this research.
Thank you. Yeah, I am no expert in raising kids and have no kids myself, but I think that's definitely why I think a lot more about, like, the educational aspect of it or, like, these implications, because I'm thinking, for example, like, also not everyone has the privilege of sending their kid to, like, Chinese school, Korean school, et cetera. I'm trying to think about who. There was a participant who mentioned that her parents are immigrants from Sri Lanka, and they speak Sinhala, or I'm not pronouncing it correctly, but, like, yes. And she mentioned that she doesn't have access to these, like, Sunday schools and things like that. So I think that's something that's also very interesting to see across participants, because while some may be able to access those spaces, like, others are not. So thinking about the ways to educate, like, future generations is definitely interesting as well.
Oh.
Last question?
I just wanted to say, kind of piggyback off of, I'm hearing the term broken when talking about language, and perhaps it's because I'm in English and I teach composition and literature, but, you know, the semantics of it, you know, I would like for us to move away from the idea of broken anything when it comes to language, rather, you know, a certain level of proficiency or fluency that is, like, being negotiated. And then also, like, because I'm in language and literacy. That's part of, like, that's some of my training. And thinking, and also even the term ESL, like English as a second language, it innately privileges English, right?
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to ELL, English language learners. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we have to also consider, like, the way that we name and call these
yeah.
things when we talk about it, too. So,
mm-hmm.
I'm gonna say my story, which might sound really weird, which is that, like, I knew some Khmer, sort of went away, and then I had my kid, and I had the very same question. I was like, you know, it's like, it's all right, but I don't know if it's enough to pass it on.
Mm.
And then, and now I'm at a place where I don't really care if I learn.
Mm.
And part of it is because my identity is no longer tied to the language
right.
in the way that it was sort of, like, forced upon me.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last thing I want us to consider is, like, when you hear certain Americans say, like, hey, you're in America, speak English. And that's interesting to me because it's, like, the inherent of notion that we should be speaking the language of the place where we are residing, right, versus, like, you know, the places from which we come from, the heritage language.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just thinking about, like, the attitudes and the various contexts and all these, like, factors that further complicate how we consider language and then how we learn and identify with it. And that's just my spiel. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much,
thank you.
Christina.